Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren, and my co-host today is the great John Copenhaver. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, Al. How are you?
It's going pretty good, actually. It's cooled down, getting rain. Fires are still going, but that's, you know, it feels like the worst is over for this year. I say right. For this year right. Because it happens every
year,
single
yeah.
year, and it just kind of doesn't change anymore. It's been that way for a while. So, but yeah, it seems to be clearing up. And doing okay, but, you know, plus, like I said, we're getting a little bit of rain, so it's a good thing, good thing. And you're back at school with all those great kids.
I am. I'm teaching all over the place these days, in college and in high school, so I'm going crazy, but it's fun.
Yeah, and I was, you know, and someone as old as you, teaching, you must hear a lot of new sayings and a lot of new phrases and catchwords and slang.
You know what is so fascinating these days are really into the things that their parents were into. So, like, they get Friends references, which I'm amazed by, or just that's, or they've all seen, you know, Empire Strikes Back or something like that, but they have no idea what happened in the 90s, you know? So you have to be like very specific 80s, you know, references, maybe early 90s, or then 2000s again. So it's just strange how like they pick up certain things.
Well, that was a long time ago. Think it, but it was, I mean, it seems like yesterday, but wow. Of course, I'm so young that I wouldn't know.
Right, you know.
Well, anyway.
It's just as fresh as it is.
Yeah, well, I just turned 17, and there you go. And that's in dog years. 102. So, now, speaking of young, fresh daisies, we've got a great writer. So now the new book, Warn Me When It's Time. And this is a Charlie Mack Motown mystery. And this is book 6 of 6. Cheryl A. Head, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I know John well and really happy to meet you, Alan.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, at the end of the show, we'll see.
Okay.
Cheryl, I find this very interesting. It seems like, first of all, this is book 6 of 6. So Charlie Mack, Motown Mystery. So I'm sort of going to take a guess that this is about a series that takes place in Detroit. or in the vicinity. And who is Charlie Mack then?
Charlie Mack is Charlene Mack, a 35, 36-year-old black queer woman who is born and raised in Detroit and has agency there. She's a type A personality, has a law degree, has run her own two companies, one a PR agency, another a martial arts school. She was recruited to the first class of Homeland Security at the end of 2001. She's a kick-ass black woman with agency in Detroit.
Wow. So now, when you do a character like that, and you do it over a series of books like this, I would imagine that you get to know your character better. Everyone does. But how do you accomplish something like that as a writer? Like, where do you kind of outline the books ahead of time? Do you kind of know where this is going? Do you know book six at the same time as you're creating book one? Or kind of maybe explain that to someone like me that writes about the true story. So I don't really get to choose where my characters are going or what I'm going to do with them. So how do you know, is this outlined?
Well, it is partially outlined, and it's been changing as I write each book. The first book was not outlined at all. The second book was, I had the idea in my head and pretty much spewed it out of my head. By book three, I realized I had written two or three or four chapters and I had no clue how it ended. So that's when I panicked. And then I decided what I would do is take a stab at writing an outline, a summary. And having the summary really helped, the outline helped. I didn't use it too much, but having it on paper and pulling out the one or two or three good ideas per chapter that I had really helped. So that's what I'm doing now by book six. Although book six, I'm kind of back to the first book where I'm just getting it out of my head. So I can't be helpful to anybody who is looking for a craft recommendation. I'm definitely not a pantser much. I feel like even when I spew it out of my head, I have it organized already in my head. But the outline is a helpful kind of cheat sheet to have, and I've started to use it more and more. And as I get deeper into the series, I'm relying on it more, on an outline more.
Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is like, so you're writing about this character over a period of time and six books.
Right.
How do you remember what she did in book one when you're doing something in book six and it's something that could be relevant to what you're writing? You know what I mean?
I don't
want to forget. You want to make sure it's all there because you know the readers will all of a sudden go, oh.
Oh, they know.
Yeah.
They notice. This
or, yeah.
They do notice. I do a pretty extensive profile on all my characters. So all the main characters, I have a two-page and growing backgrounder so I can remember small things like the color of their car, the name of their mother, the nickname they were given in childhood, that kind of thing. So while I may not have an outline all the time, I do have these backgrounders on every character. On some of the secondary characters, I find I do that as well, just so I can remember things. But for the trajectory of the series, it really does help me to know that Charlie's Corvette is white and not blue, as I tried to say in one of my other.
We'll try to get it painted.
That's right.
You know, just how it reflected in the sun.
Yeah.
So, but who is Charlie Mack, Charlene, for you? Like, is this person from you? Like, quite a few of the fiction writers I've had on have said that they, you know, they're in every one of their characters, so they're part of it.
But, I totally buy into that.
Yeah. So are you a lot of this character with elements of other people you've met or seen through your life that you've thrown in?
Yeah, I'm a lot of this character. She has more assets than I have, ones probably that I wish I had. But I'm a lot of her, and as I write her, and when I notice it the most, Alan, is when I get notes back from my editor, she'll say things like, what did Charlie feel after she killed that man? And I said, well, what do you mean? He deserved to die. And she said, no. But what it didn't, you know, most people would feel something. And I went, they would? You know? So I do see myself in her in terms of my being able to distance myself. I certainly have a code that I think is important. I'm certainly, I do think I'm an empathetic person. There are a lot of qualities she has that are mine, for sure. But I can say that about all the other partners in her agency. Don Rutkowski is a white man, kind of an acerbic white guy who's an amalgam of every white man I've known well, especially growing up in Detroit. I've had some really fine white male mentors and some really fine white male nemesis. And Don is the guy who allows me to just say the crazy stuff I want to say. And I rarely have to think much about what he's going to say. He's my reactive side. So yes, I find myself in every character, especially the main characters I have. They have some of the same interests I have, for sure. Some of the same flaws I have. I'm admitting that. This is like therapy, Alan.
Yeah. What do you say?
Little did I know.
Yeah, we can go a little deeper here then. Because when you are actually writing it down, that's one thing, because if you're putting a lot of feelings in how you are, and as you call them, your flaws, and the good things and the bad things and all this sort of stuff, and you're putting it into this character.
Yeah.
But you're actually writing it down for people to read, and you're getting it published, and you're putting it out there so that everybody can pick up this book or the ebook and read it. Doesn't that kind of make you feel a little vulnerable in a sense? Doesn't it kind of expose some of who you are to a lot of people you don't even know?
It could, but you don't even know the stuff I'm holding back. So even though that is a filter through which I write these characters, the stuff I don't commit to paper, oh my goodness, you'd have to write a novel about me, Alan.
Oh boy, see this.
Oh boy,
this could be your insider's club. They have to pay $9 a month and get the deep stuff. You know.
It's so funny because I agree with Cheryl. There's so much you don't, you know, you are crafting something for someone to see, and it's part of you, right? When you're writing fiction, but it's not, you know, all of you. And I think it's even true when you're writing like creative nonfiction or memoir, that kind of thing. There's still there. I mean, you still have to give out more of yourself through that kind of thing. But even that, you know, you don't let it all out. Or it's probably not good.
Yeah, but you,
that's right. Really
yeah, that's right. Get on Twitter. I mean, what I'm saying is, you see, because your characters are very important to you, and that's in both your cases. You're both writing fiction, but your characters are very important in how they act and react and what they're doing, and that there's a lot more to it, which we can get into. But I think that what I'm saying is, so when you have Charlie Mack do something and react to something in a certain way, all of a sudden that kind of exposes who you are.
Absolutely. It does.
That's sort of the peak. So all of a sudden they don't need to know a whole lot more about you, but those critics on Twitter can all of a sudden take that and kind of go, this is who you are. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Because I get that myself at times, and now I'm pretty iron, so I just let it slide right off, but you know, because you can get kind of people that make wrong assumptions. So, but the point to what I'm saying is, so for Cheryl, what was it that made you decide that you could write and people would care about this?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that's a different question than the one I heard you pose the first time.
Well, yeah, I'm just going to say I'm easing you into this.
You are. You're luring me in.
I'm a therapist that gets you in, and it's like American Horror Story, and all of a sudden you're there, and it's like, how do you go back? Oh, no.
Right. Well, I wanted to kind of respond to this thing about how I am in my characters and they are of me. I talked a little bit about empathy. I do believe I'm an empathetic person, and I give lots of room to my characters to talk to me. They don't always, but I will often just stop in the middle of writing and kind of walk around and say, you know, what are you going to do about this? You know, I have a conversation in my head with the characters. I don't have to do that with Don. He just comes to me. But for the other characters, I do. And I've had that one, only one time so far, rare occasion where a character just literally spoke to me, woke me out of a sleep to talk to me. And I was enthralled by that experience and want to have it again. So, but I'm always open to the character telling me what they want to say. And I tried to do that in this latest book with this domestic terrorist. I really wanted his words to come out of my fingers onto the keyboard and not speak for him. I try very hard to do that. The question about the kind of the ego that it takes to write and think that other people will be interested in your writing, I guess that happened sort of by accident for me. The first book I wrote was kind of a labor of love. I felt it was important to talk about Negro soldiers in World War II, to rebut what I'd seen in a Ken Burns documentary. And so that was a lot of research and labor of love. That's where the character spoke to me and told me he was gay. I went, oh, okay, let me go back to the drawing board. In subsequent books, I'm really thinking about talking to people about diversity and tolerance and race hatred and class and the things I'm interested in. And I feel like I have a voice that needs to be shared. It's certainly a little bit of ego, you know, it's maybe more than a little bit of ego. But I keep a person in mind as my primary audience, and that is a white woman in Iowa, believe it or not. And I'm trying to write in a way that she can learn something about my world and come and see it with a different kind of color, different kind of filter, to see a gay, black, cis female person and her life in a way that they might not have imagined before and certainly wouldn't see on television.
It's interesting because the subject matter too, like you write about very serious subjects. This is like very true to life, you know, of what is going on in the world, particularly in the U.S. It's really focused upon, and it's something that draws a lot of lines. Like you see people very polarized right now. You see very people very tribal. So how do you think you can get through to that white woman in Iowa when it's so separated right now?
But by showing her that I can also write Don Rutkowski and that I can have a fondness for Don. I'm fond of Don, as is Charlie, because there are other values he has, other characteristics he has. He certainly has his own humor. He's the guy you want in a knife fight or a gunfight or any fight for that matter. So his bravery, his loyalty, just to let the person know. I really eschew this notion that we have right now that either you're with me or you're against me. You know, that we want to demonize people so quickly. I just don't think it helps us at all to do that. And so the kind of cancel culture thing we have going on is not who I am. There are people I don't like. They're not that many people I don't like, though. But there never will be people that I won't be kind of curious about why they think the way they do, even if it's crazy. You know, I'm always thinking, well, why does the serial killer do that? You know, I kind of want to understand what goes on there, and not for the purpose of saying you're crazy and unfriend me, but for the purpose of saying, you know, what makes you tick? And where do you fit in this grand scheme of things? And I think it's a curiosity, and I think it's ego, and I think it's I think that's the reason writers write. We think we have something to say, and then we have a voice. And some of us write without even expecting audience, or like Toni Morrison says, she writes without the white gaze. I think I'm somewhat cognizant of the white gaze, especially since, you know, my primary audience woman is this white woman.
So do you actually have something in mind? So when somebody, not just Iowa woman.
Yeah.
But, you know, we call her Rita. So not just Rita, but when somebody goes to the bookstore or they're surfing online and they go through and they see your books and they go, I'll pick that one. And they read it. At the end of it, of course, there's the story. You know, there's the things that Charlie Mack does and the interactions and the crimes and all that stuff. But is there an underlying subtext that you're hoping that they get? Do you actually have that built in?
Yes. I guess if I would put it in one word, it's probably always tolerance. And there sometimes it's more subtle than other times. John will tell you this, I get this comment all the time when I'm doing book readings and going to book clubs and things. They're going like, there's an awful lot of eating in your books. And I'm going like, yep, there are. And there always will be, because everybody eats, and everybody likes pizza, and everybody likes Chinese, and everybody, you know. So I put that in there as a way to say, hey, I'm black queer, and I like burger stew, you know. It's subtle, but I think it's important. You know, I just like music is an opening to connect us all as human beings. So, you know, I don't know if it's any, you know, grand scheme or not, but it's always kind of in the back of my mind. It's why I write about a woman who's Charlie's mother, who's early onset Alzheimer's. You know, that when I learn about something that intrigues me, like Alzheimer's did when I was working in public broadcasting, I funded a program about Alzheimer's, and I didn't really know much about it at all. And when I found out what a mean disease it is, I really wanted to learn as much as I could about it. So that's why that storyline is in there.
What influences you when you're writing something? Like, how do you come up with the actual story behind one of these books?
Yeah, I'm a news junkie. When I was really young, I worked in Detroit in television and radio news. So I remain a news junkie. I'm always watching news and reading news and listening. And, you know, when I read a Sunday New York Times, I must find 7 or 8 stories that probably could be novels. I'm not wired to write all those, but I spot them and go like, oh, that would be a good story. So I think I'm paying attention to the world in a way that I know my partner doesn't pay attention this way. She's probably looking at me like, what? You know, maybe John, you do this too. You know, you go to a place and you look over and you think, wow, that little remote house, wow, I could see a murder happening there. Or you see a person on the street and they're in some kind of angst. And you think, wow, I wonder what they're going through. So it's really being observational. It's really being curious about everything you see that's different and that you don't know about. And I think it's also a kind of a discernment about what's I was when I was working in news, I was pretty good about having a nose for it, as they say, and what I would cover and that kind of thing.
Hmm. Well, when you're so involved in the story, because it kind of relates to what's going on around you and stuff, mm-hmm. I wonder if, do you feel a certain amount of stress when you write one of these books and when you come out of it? If you do, how do you, what do you do to unwind or distress?
Yeah, I do. This last one, I was under a lot of duress. I was going, like, what the hell? You know, there's a lot of gardening. I dig in dirt and stuff like that. I could probably be a grave digger. That would probably be my line of work. I do things that are physical, things that will make me sweat. That really helps. So, you know, really good exercise, but a lot. I mean, when I say yard work, I mean, I tackle, you know, let's build a fence, you know, or something like that. And that really usually is very helpful for me. I don't get really stressed out about, most of the time, I'm really aware this is fiction. But then this last book, oh, my goodness, I was in the head of these guys, and the research took me onto some of their sites and things, and it was demoralizing. It really was. Chocolate, red wine, that helps.
Yeah. So basically you bury the bodies. That's
yeah.
Well, that's, I would say it's really, really, really hard to do that. So your research actually takes you into these places that you don't always really, first of all, probably know exist. And then when you find them, you're probably not really thrilled with them.
No, I mean, I knew they had websites, these alt-right groups, but then you go online and actually see the stuff they're talking about, and it is, you know, it's just bizarre. And it's like, you don't want to accept that there are that many people who feel that way or think that way. But then you remember that you have just come out of 4 years of a presidency that you would never imagine in your worst nightmare. So then you just accept it. You don't, you accept that there are people who just have lost their minds. I don't know if my books can help them. <You know>? I don't know if I can reach them, but I would want to try. I would want to find some common thread that would pull them back from the abyss of insanity. You know, can't always do it. And, you know, especially in the culture we have now with the divisiveness we have now. But I would always want to give it, have an opening, leave an opening. I mean, even if we just talked about the best barbecue sauce, you know, let's find some common ground.
Yeah, it's sort of distressing. I was I'm sort of still in shock over the last years and sort of how it went from just not liking that. You know, I don't like a Southern redneck or two. You know, you just don't like them. But, you know, but nowadays there's this, like, real passion to hate who you don't get or who you're not really into. Well, all of a sudden they're the enemy. They're completely, it's gone much further than I ever expected it to.
And if we stay on that path, what is there for the United States of America except, you know, war, civil war, race war? You know, how do you hold out hope? I was reading, there was something in the New York Times last week about Derrick Bell, who had written during the civil rights movement about his feeling that we could never really aspire to the kind of goals the civil rights movement had. And he got, you know, he got ostracized for those opinions, but I'm starting to see what he means. I think that, you know, a country built on the foundation of holding other people back, seeing certain people seeing themselves as more important, better than, smarter than, superior to other people, and that's the stuff they're talking about on these chat rooms. I can't remember the name they have for people who are not as smart as them, but it's something, you know, they have a phrase for it, and they really think they're right. They think the country was built by the founding fathers who were white male for white people, and they say it out loud, you know? And so I don't know what to do with that except to say that, you know, maybe climate change or some other horrific thing will smack us on the head, you know, so hard that we just come out and you say, wow, wait a minute, you know, have an epiphany about it.
Well, we don't want everybody coming up to Canada. We're building a wall. just so you know.
I'm coming to Canada. I'm coming.
We've just about had it, okay? Enough is enough. You know, what happened to the good old days? You know? I kind of have conversations with them. You're kind of involved with them.
Yeah.
See, this is the real kind of twister for me because I don't get this because I have no relationship with anybody except for the ones I meet. And it could be written about in my book. It can be what I cover. Mm-hmm. But they're real. So I don't hear voices. I'm not walking down the road and talking to myself and talking to a voice. Or I'm not. And this is, I get this from a lot of fiction writers, good fiction writers. So what do you think that is? Like, is that part of the creative process?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's giving yourself over to the art, you know. I think it's wanting to do right by the characters to the so much that you don't want to say that what they wouldn't say, you know, and allowing that character to speak through you. You know, I think it's a, you know, I think it's like a sweet spot. It's like, you know, it's, I think I made this analogy in my first book. It's like the jazz pianist who just lets them, you know, he's not even, the music, his fingers are doing all the work. He's just there as a vehicle to let the music out. I mean, I would love if that happened to be in every single book. Because it is, you know, in some ways it's spiritual work when you're giving personality to a character that doesn't exist. You know, you're building the character, you know, you're doing, you know, my God's work. So you want it to be a spiritual act, and you want that person to be authentic. You know, at least I do want that person to be authentic. So I was, even though I was, you know, shocked and had to do a lot of work, I dismantled that first book when the character told me something about him I didn't know, and it was a better book for it.
And I guess you, as you get into the character throughout the books, does that become easier for you to write with them and for them and what they're going to do?
Yes.
It becomes, yes, you get more into it.
Yeah, you start to know their personality, and you can, you know, you've heard actors who've been in long form projects say, oh, my character wouldn't say that. You know, you get to know them enough to know what they would say and what they wouldn't say.
Wow. And does it get harder to write more things that happen to that character then?
Probably, because I'm having a really difficult time with my Alzheimer's character, who I really like. And my editor keeps saying, you know, we've got to do something about Ernestine. You know, how would Ernestine really be able to do that now? And I'm really reluctant. I don't want to kill her off. So, yeah, you start to feel for them. They start to be, they're real for you. And I've been postponing it, but I'm thinking the next book or two, I'm starting writing the seventh book, and I'm really considering whether that one should be about her further demise into dementia.
Well, maybe she becomes a serial killer.
And I've got some candidates for her.
Don't write that show. Don't listen to
her. Think about it. Get her into doing something really evil. She just wakes up really evil.
I mean, it's a mean disease. That's what I realized early on. It, you know, you don't know your loved ones. Your personality can change. You can be very belligerent. And that's it's so hard on the caregivers.
Oh, yeah. I could imagine it would be a terrible struggle to deal with that, because you kind of lose the person and you're gaining someone new that is not who they were. And then you have to deal with those changes, and it's not always pretty. So serial killer works great. I'm selling it, man.
I have been fascinated by serial killers. I've done some research, and when you go on Wikipedia and put serial killer in there, they're pages and pages of these people. Yeah. It's amazing. There's a fascination about it. You know, there are lots of books and lots of TV and movies about serial killers. So I don't think I'll ever write one. I don't know. I may, but I don't think so. If I do, Charlie's going to catch him and kick him.
Right.
Oh, come on. She'd be out there with a big knife. Just going crazy. Just had it. That's, you know, it's kind of like I've had it with this world, and going to go out there and blow it up, you know. So what do you plan on doing with Charlie? How long will you take a series like this?
Yeah, you know, Alan, I was thinking about this the other day. I think I have 3 to 6 more Charlie books in me. I'm trying to balance them out. At first, I was writing them just to entertain myself. So the first one was a missing person case with lots of complexity. The second one was a thriller because I love thrillers, and I just wanted to try that and had fun with it. And I bored some of my readers with all the detail, but it's the kind of stuff I love in thrillers. And so I'm trying to make sure I'm stepping in and stepping out. And by that, I mean focus more sometimes on the personal relationships that Charlie has. So the story is a little bit more interior, and then back out and do some bigger topic like homelessness, which I've done in one book, in this book about domestic terrorists. But I was inspired by book six by the knuckleheaded cohort of men who decided they should kidnap and murder the governor of Michigan. I thought, what the heck is going on with these guys? And who are these guys? And where did they come from? And since my book is set in the mid-2000s, I thought, well, they didn't just come out whole cloth wanting to murder the governor. They must have been planning for a while. And so this book really looks at the nascent growth of these hate crime groups in Detroit and around the country at the first term of the Obama administration, when they really came out of the woodwork. There's an FBI report, 2009 report, about how they are proliferating and how many assassination attempts were thwarted against then-candidate Obama. It's mind-blowing. And I wanted to write about that just because I'm curious about what makes them tick. And that's also why I wanted to be in the head of one or two of them to really kind of explain who they are, I guess, to me.
Cheryl, you know, your latest book was reviewed in the New York Times, which was so cool. And it's kind of a first in a lot of ways, smaller press, getting that exposure. I mean, how did that feel for you?
Oh, man, that felt good.
Yeah. And you, I mean, is this a hopeful? You feel like this is hopeful? Are the smaller presses, more diverse voices, getting more exposure? What are your feelings about?
I think that, COVID was horrible and mean, but it had its ups for creative people. But, you know, people were at home. They didn't have anything to do. They were scared. They were bored. And they tried new things. And I think they tried new media. And I think they read books they hadn't read before. And so I think we got some attention for small press offerings. And I'm hoping they get a taste of it and they want to stay with it and see the kind of quality that they can find in small press works. And those kind of quality and interesting topics they can find in LGBTQ themed books, you know, to look at books with African-American protagonists in a different way, you know. Charlie, I think it will surprise people who read it and don't know anything about reading an African-American protagonist. She's not that far removed from, you know, some of the white male protagonists they might read in their favorite mystery series. They have same archetypes, some of the same tropes are there, but with a spin on it and with a kind of a different worldview because she is a black queer woman. But I think they will enjoy the journey, and I think they will enjoy kind of the things they like about mysteries and crime fiction because those are there as well. But I will say the New York Times really does boost your sales.
Yeah. I imagine, and I was delighted to see that, and it was certainly very hopeful. And I think it's really interesting, too, that when people open themselves to reading books like yours or any sort of voice or point of view they are not used to, they recognize so much. That's familiar. Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
That's what we all thrive for. We, you know, especially mystery writers and crime writers, we write the genre because we love the genre and grew up reading it, and we don't want to destroy it, but we might want to bend it a little, you know.
Right.
So, I still love all the stuff I've read before, and I will still love all the British mysteries I see now. But I want, and I also want to see myself in these situations and in these books and in these offerings. And I think lots of audiences are impatient to find that now.
I agree. Yes.
You know, I mean, some of us just are not that lucky.
Hey, I felt really lucky, Alan. I'll tell you.
Just wait. Oh,
I'll sleep my way to the top. I'll sleep my way to the top. Come on. No, I don't. Yeah, but what do you think the if someone had never read your books before, mm-hmm. what would you suggest that they read if they were to pick one book mm-hmm. Of yours to get to know a little bit about your writing and who you are? Mm-hmm. What would you say for them to get?
I'd have to say it would be one of two things. Either the first book I wrote, which is not the Charlie Mack Motown mystery, it's called Long Way Home, a World War II story. It has all the elements I like to write about: diversity and tolerance and curiosity about the world. And there's food. It's historical fiction, but there's a murder and there's crime in it. That one really starts to explore the themes I would later pick up for the series. And then I guess book one in the series, because it introduces the characters. I don't think the writing maybe is as good, because I'm learning as I go and I'm writing better as I go, but the story is just full of heart and full of twists and turns, and I'm one of those people who hates knowing the end a third of the way through, and so there's some surprises at the end. And you know, I did some plot acrobatics in that I really like, and introduced character Charlie as a character along with her band of merry men and women.
It's real interesting when you did the historical fiction book, or the, you know, about World War II.
Yeah.
What would the research and everything?
Oh my God.
Yeah, because I know what
brutal.
It takes.
It was grueling, grueling. That's why I wrote a mystery afterwards.
He has to take a break. Because I could imagine, because not only the history and getting it right, but also the little things, like the details of how people talk to each other, how they live, just all the other things.
Lucky enough, as John was at this time, to live in the D.C. area and be neighbors with the Library of Congress. I live on Capitol Hill. I spent a lot of time in the Library of Congress, in their archives, and both their letter archives and photographic archives. There's not a lot written about Black soldiers who didn't go to the home front. You know, we hear about the Tuskegee Airmen, and there's a couple battalions who went to the European theater and a couple that went to the Pacific theater. But most, 85% of Black soldiers during World War II stayed in the home front and did menial tasks and did the things that the war required to build, you know, to do things like bury people and to get supplies where they needed to go. But the soldiers who volunteered, many of them volunteered, some were drafted, but they expected to have a different kind of service, one of glory. They expected to fight. They would have been really great fighters had we deployed them in that way. And so it's a story about the courage of the people who stayed in uniform, did the best they could every day as second-class soldiers, treated by the American military as second-class soldiers. And so it's set in 1943, when we're 2 years into the war, and it's about a young man and a young woman who come from their small farms in the rural South and find themselves on an army base in Arizona, meet, fall in love, meet a bunch of people, and it's coming of age, and it talks about the courage of their service.
Sounds pretty amazing. Okay, so now, how do people find you? I get a hold of you, follow you.
I am everywhere, but Tumblr. I'm not on Tumblr. I don't think I will ever be on TikTok. I don't think you'll ever find me on TikTok. However, I said that about Twitter about 7 years ago, too.
Apparently, people are doing well with selling. There's a lot of TikTok
book talk
folks that are
right?
book talk.
Oh,
yeah.
Well.
Okay.
Yeah, but TikTok, I will say, TikTok has really gotten harsh the last little while. It's pretty mean. There's a lot of negativity up there. It seems like it's moved right over from Facebook to TikTok because it's wild. It's like the Wild West right now.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, maybe I will avoid that.
I'm avoiding it, Cheryl.
I say see what happens. See what they do with
I think it's fabulous when I see the dance videos.
I used to go there to cheer myself up. I used to go on and flip through and kind of get a few laughs and then go to work type thing.
Okay.
But now you get on and it's like, it's all politics and it's all, it's all abortion. It's all this and that. And it's just like, God, every video, it's just like, I can't.
Oh, darn it.
I'm just getting really depressed doing it. It used to be my laugh place, but now.
Yeah. Oh, we all need laugh places. We need laughter.
I'd say give it time. See if they kind of start cleaning it up a little bit.
Okay.
If not, then.
Yeah. Well, then you won't find me on TikTok.
but you have a website.
Where will we find you?
When I am on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. I do a really bad job on Instagram. I'm one of those people, old people who has a phone and always forgets. It's also a camera. And Instagram's driven by photographs, so I'm doing better, but not as good as I must. And so that's easy to find me. It's my name most of the time. On Twitter, it's CHEADDC, but it's Cheryl Head on Facebook. Instagram, CHEADWrites. Welcome hearing from people. I have a website. It's not a great one, but I do have one.
Do you like sort of the way it is now with social media and all the stuff going on?
I do like social media. I have begun to embrace it. And when you work for a small press, you have to do it all yourself, so there's nobody encouraging you. So I've gotten pretty good at it. I mean, kind of understand the rhythm of at least Facebook and Twitter. Instagram, not so much. I could always do better because you do have to write sometimes too and not just like people and retweet people and, say they have gorgeous kids and pets. Yeah. All of whom do, by the way, all of my friends do. you come to discover the things that work and the things that don't and kind of keep up with trends. I do think that Twitter, even with all its misinformation, has better breaking news than CNN. I'll put it that way. If there's something afoot, you can go on Twitter and get wind of it pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think all of those national news places out of the U.S., CNN, Fox, all those have just got like a storyline now. They don't really, it's not like a news channel anymore.
How can everything be breaking news, okay?
Yeah. it gets a bit much. And all of this is, and they have their panel and experts and all that sort of stuff. And it's kind of boring. But I will say I really like the title of your book, too, Warn Me When It's Time.
Thank you. That actually
is pretty eerie. In a way.
Yeah. I have a formula for the titles that my publisher now will not let me divert from. From the first one, we bounced around ideas for the title, and I think I came up with Bury Me When I'm Dead. And so now she says to me, when I tried to go off the script, she said, nope, five words, two strong first words, two strong last words, and it has to have I'm or it's in it. Oh, wow. So I have maybe 20 or 30 versions of titles that some are better than others, and I'm following the formula.
Yeah, do you have any censored ones?
What, Alex? That's going to make it fun for me.
That's what I want to see.
I love that.
I'm looking for that one.
Several popped into mind just now.
Yeah. I think so, but what do I know? Crazy Canadian.
I'll send it to you offline.
Okay, perfect. I'm into that. That's great. It's all good. It's all good. Well, how was the pandemic for you? Did this kind of get in the way of when you were finishing one of these books to come out, like this last one that just came out here in June? How was it for you writing?
It started off slow. I mean, I remember thinking and telling people about this, that so the first couple of months, maybe a month and a half, I thought I was going to die. You know, I thought I was taking my temperature twice a day, you know. And then you realize, okay, I'm probably not going to get it. I kind of hunkered down with my partner in her house with two dogs, which I've never lived with two dogs before, so that was different. And I'm an introvert, so I thought, what's wrong with wearing a mask every day and staying away from people? So that I got into that pretty fast. But and then at the same time, so there was a conflation of things, you know, and then George Floyd happened, and I was outraged. Mm-hmm. So I put aside my Charlie Mack book I was writing and wrote another novel, and I wrote a second, first part of another series. So I used the outrage and channeled it into writing.
Yeah. No, I was just wondering because a big thing, when there's a lot of stress like that going mm-hmm. on around in your life, mm-hmm. so you're sitting there and you've got the pandemic and then you've got climate change, you've got George Floyd, you've got, Donald Trump, you've got, like, there's all of this stuff going on, and with it comes a lot of craziness, and it's daily.
Yeah.
So that level of stress, now, do you think that's going to seep into your writing? Does that come into your book somehow, you think?
No, not so much, because I am paying attention to the world. So I think some of the topics that come up might slip into the books, but I did a pretty good job. I'm not a person who really likes to read or look at escapism much, but I did a little bit, you know, around that 4 years of that president. Yeah. I realized I watched a lot of Cary Grant movies.
Yeah.
Here's a white guy I can love, you know?
Yeah. I just wonder. I just wonder what it's going to be like in 20 years.
Yeah.
When people look back at it, and if you look back at your writing in 20 years, or if you look back at things, if you'll pick up or notice things that you don't now because of what's going on. You know, because when you look at it, because when you talk about serial killers, you know, a lot of them come from the generation that their fathers, especially the males, the white males, their fathers mm-hmm. were at the war, come back, and they were taught to be men. You don't touch, you don't hug, you're not in the same, like they, you didn't deal with feelings, because feelings mm-hmm. was not what a man does. So mm-hmm. there were, that created, I think, a whole lot of serial killers and nut jobs in the 60s and 70s, you know, the Charles Manson thing and all that. Mm-hmm. Right? I think there was a ton of it. And I think that I just wonder if what's going on now is going to create something that we'll see in 20, 30 years. It might not be killers, but I just wonder what effect it's going to have on our young children right now.
Right, right. It could have some positive effect on young children, but I think, you know, I think people who are millennials and people who lost jobs and couldn't get them back and who felt a bit of malaise about what do I do with my life now, that might impact them in 20 or 30. I mean, they say the gig economy is booming and that people learn to be creative about work. And I don't know if that's not, I think that's a pretty good thing, actually.
Yeah.
I think people tried new art and new, you know, I was teasing someone about all the single white and African American and other kinds of men I saw walking around with babies and dogs without their wives. And, you know, and imagine how these wives were going like, please get out of the house, take the baby, take the dog and be gone 2 hours, you know. So I think, you know, I think it gave people a new way to look at themselves and their lives and the role they play in their families and in their communities. And as an introvert, when I was out walking, you could see the people, you could see the extroverts. They were like vibrating to just see other people, you know, and you could see they wanted to come up and talk to me. And I, of course, didn't want to talk to them. So it was interesting.
No, I get it. I'm the same way. I don't want to talk to anybody. Just leave me alone. You know? Go out, go out to the supermarket and people, oh, that's what you buy for dinner. Yeah. Get away.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting question, Alan, because you wonder when people feel have a year where they don't think they really have control of much, whether that shows up later as wanting to be really controlling about their lives or something like that.
Yeah, because so much of what we do is also a reaction to what's happening to us,
right.
or happening to someone we know, and how serious it is how dramatic it can be, right? So it's I just wonder, I stay hidden and I watch. the one time Al goes out to a store and he goes to Costco, and get there. And you've got the big, huge lineup, It takes you an hour to get in. And but right when I get to the lineup, the guy in front of me is not going to wear a mask. And no matter what, and his freedom. And then you have to get the manager out there. And meanwhile, it's like, oh, you've got to be kidding. The one time I go out to the store. So then I'd go home and I write about killing this guy that's in the Costco. and it feels good.
Costco, yeah.
Well, anyway.
It's easy to get in a killing mood in Costco, in my
I think, more so than even Walmart. And I just don't go to Walmart. But, it's definitely more enraged. I'll tell you. But anyway, it's not important.
I've been thinking about the people in January 6th, how desperate they must have been to do the things they did. That desperation came from someplace, and fear, fear and desperation.
I agree. And you watch it all and you see it and you just people don't understand it, but then you realize what it must have been like where they were living and what was around them and why they got into that so badly. And I see that, not just that, but in any other thing that when we look at it and go, wow, I wonder why that guy's, what a nutball, we say and stuff, but you rethink about it, man, I wonder where they came from and what is it that they are so angry about?
Right.
Well, I also think that we have to look about not just the what, but how does someone actually get in their minds, get sort of on a track and get locked into that track. And it's that isolation, and that isolation can be online as much as it can be in person. And, so I keep on wondering about, it's not just the thing that they're after, but how do they get so, into this one point of view, so entrenched in this one point of view, what were the series of steps? So it's kind of, I bet we'll look back and that will be something we'll look back and sort of analyze.
Right.
So the book we're telling you that you must buy, because it's the best book available right now, it's called Warn Me When It's Time. It's a Charlie Mack Motown mystery. It's book 6. The author is Cheryl A. Head, and she's been our guest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What an interesting conversation and therapeutic. I don't have to go to therapy this month.
Thank you, Jeff.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.